Dr. William Lane Craig writes of this question, does God exist? He wrote, C.S. Lewis once remarked that God is not the sort of thing one can be moderately interested in. After all, if God does not exist, there's no reason to be interested in God at all. On the other hand, if God does exist, then this is of paramount interest, and our ultimate concern ought to be how to be properly related to this being upon whom we depend moment by moment for our very existence. So people who shrug their shoulders and say, does God exist? What difference does it make? Merely show that they haven't yet thought very deeply about the problem. And in this lesson, I would like to answer the question rationally, logically, does God exist? But first, Lego. Sterling had his first week of first grade, and he did a great job. I called his teacher on Friday and said, how was his week? She said, he did great. And I like to reward Sterling with a Lego set every now and then, so I got a Lego set, and promises are promises, and good dads keep their promises. So I'm going to go ahead and build a Lego set for Sterling while we're here together. It's an easy-to-build tractor trailer, and it has a little scooper right there and two little men and some junk that they're picking up. Road work truck, 132 pieces, by the way. Still easy to build, though, even with 132 pieces. Now, I think the way that you do these Legos is you open up the box, you got all the pieces in there, and then I think they kind of build themselves, don't they? See if I can do this without spilling the Legos too bad. By the way, blame Rick Moore. He's the one who introduced props and things to preaching up here. Now, I dropped a few of them. But you know what? When you've got most of the pieces, what's the big deal? I think you just zip it up and put that away for now. For the time being, though, I want to ask another question. Is belief in God just a matter of a blind leap of faith? A lot of times people will think of faith in that regard, and they'll quote 2 Corinthians chapter 5 and verse 7, where it says, for we walk by faith and not by sight. And often those who expound on this verse, this statement about faith, imply that it is something less than real, meaningful, substantial knowledge. Many so-called theologians, including the German theologian Hans Küng, I have two of his books, by the way, in my office, upheld this idea of faith when he wrote, even in faith, then, there is no certainty entirely from doubt. In faith, we must commit ourselves to something uncertain. And sadly for Hans Küng, this sounds a lot like the televangelist Robert Schuller, who once said in 1984 that faith is a commitment to an unprovable assumption. The strange thing about that is that I think we just sang a song a few minutes ago that's taken directly from 2 Timothy chapter 1 and verse 12, where the Apostle Paul said this about his belief in God. For this reason, I also suffer these things, but I'm not ashamed, for I know whom I have believed, and I am convinced that he is able to guard what I have entrusted to him until that day. The Apostle Paul didn't see belief in God as just being something to ponder, something to think about. He didn't see it as just a hobby topic, and he certainly didn't put it on the same level as the Easter Bunny or Santa Claus. I know who I've believed. I know who I have faith in. And I'm convinced that the one I have faith in is able to guard the thing that I have entrusted to him, which is his very soul. After all, like Paul wrote in 1 Corinthians chapter 15, if there is no resurrection, and I suppose by extension, if there is no God and there is no spirit and there is no heaven and there is no hell, then we've just wasted our lives. We've entrusted our essence to a God who doesn't exist and whose promises are meaningless. Is faith then merely the acceptance of something that cannot be proven? Many people mistakenly assume that whatever the opposite of walking by sight is from 2 Corinthians 5 must be walking by blindness. that if you're not walking by sight, whatever it is you're walking, however it is, must be blind. Yet this definition of God makes him into nothing but a curiosity. He's something that you can either believe or not believe with equal validity, almost like believing that there's life on other planets. I could never prove to you scientifically that there is life on other planets. But you know what? You could never prove to me scientifically that there isn't life on other planets. Is that all God is, though? Is God just something that the theist and the atheist are just going to spend the rest of our lives going in circles about? Well, you can't prove God doesn't exist. Well, you can't prove God does exist. Is that what faith is supposed to be, though? Or I just accept one side of an unprovable equation? Is that the definition that the writer of Hebrews gives in Hebrews chapter 11 and verse 1, where he says this of faith? Now, faith is the assurance of things hoped for, the conviction of things not seen. Let's seize upon that statement for a moment, the idea of not seen. Because that seems to be the same idea that Paul is getting at in 2 Corinthians 5, verse 7, where we walk by faith and not by sight. We walk by faith and not by things that we see. That doesn't mean that faith is blind. It simply means that faith does not depend on sight. Faith does not depend on things that it can see to be fully assured and fully convicted that they are true. Within the context of 2 Corinthians 5 itself, Paul gives a clarification. He says later on in verse 16 of that chapter, "Therefore, from now on, we regard no one according to the flesh," as in flesh that we can see. I can see you and you can see me. I can see the president. I can see Olympians on TV. I see them. But he says, "We do not regard anyone according to the flesh or what we can see. Even though we have known Christ according to the flesh," we've literally seen him, "yet now we no longer see him thus." In other words, what Paul is saying is, at one point, we could see Jesus. At one point, in essence, we were walking by sight because he was among us. He dwelt among us, lived among us, breathed the same air, ate the same food. I think that's what 1 John chapter 1 is talking about. "That which we've seen with our eyes and beheld with our hands, we proclaim to you now also." We once walked by sight, and our faith depended on that sight. We believed in Jesus because we could see Jesus, but now we no longer see him. So our faith must be in something other than sight. Our faith must be more substantial than just saying, "Well, if you can see Jesus, then I guess you can believe in him." You remember what Jesus had to say to Thomas when Thomas came to Jesus after his crucifixion and had some doubts about the veracity of the statement that Jesus had been resurrected. Jesus said this in John 20 and verse 29, after Thomas finally admitted, "Well, I do believe you now that I've seen you and I've seen the wounds in your hands and your feet and the wound in your side." Jesus said, "Because you have seen me, you have believed. Blessed are those who have not seen and yet believed." And I think that this is what Paul is talking about. He's not saying that faith walks by blindness. He's saying that faith walks by something other than seeing the physical Jesus. Let's talk about that for a minute then. Faith does not require sight. How does that work? How can you say that you believe and you're fully assured and you're convicted that Jesus is real, that he is everything he claimed to be, and that he is in heaven at the right hand of God at this time, yet without even seeing him? I'll give you an analogy. I love analogies, don't I? Speaking of analogies, still not done. Do you know your house pretty well? Yeah, of course you do. Even in the dark when you're wandering around, do you know where pretty much every light switch is in your house? And you can find the bathroom in the middle of the night, and when you need to go downstairs to get a drink of water, you can find the stairs, and you know, we're not all just tripping around. You know where your couch is, don't you? I mean, you put it somewhere during the day. You walk by faith and not by sight, don't you, in the middle of the night in your house? Why? Why do you walk by faith and not by sight in the middle of your own home, and yet you know where everything is? Because you knew that when there was light in the house during the daytime, you put your couch right here. And you never moved your couch. And your wife never moved your couch. And your kids are too small to move your couch. And your puppy certainly didn't move your couch. So you are fully assured and fully convicted that your couch is going to be in the dark in the exact same place that it was in the light. So when you're wandering around in the dark, trying to go downstairs, trying to get to the kitchen or the bathroom, you know where your couch is. Even though you can't see it, you know where it is. You walk by faith and not by sight. And that is not a blind, empty faith, okay? That is not an insubstantial faith. It is a faith based on reason and logic, because you reason in your mind in the dark, in the middle of the night. Well, I know where my couch is during the daytime. I didn't move my couch. Therefore, at night, my couch is in the same place that it's always been. That's reason, isn't it? That's logic. Now, you can't see your couch, but you, by faith, in a reasoned, logical, convicted faith, walk through your house. And again, the same is true. You know where your bathroom is. Was your bathroom in the same place during the day? Of course it was. Well, it will be in the same place at night. Was the light switch in the same place on the wall that it was during the day, every single day, from the time the house was first built? Well, then you have full assurance of faith that when you're looking for the light switch, it's still going to be there even in the dark. So we have reliable witness testimony. We have an incredibly credible New Testament account. The most credible book in human history. The most credible book from the ancient world. We have reason and logic at our disposal that leads us to the conclusion that there must be a God, not that there could be a God, or hopefully there's a God, or maybe there's a God, but reasonably, logically, rationally, there must be a God. And I want to spend the rest of our lesson talking about this reasonable belief that there is a God. Why does everything exist after all? Now, the atheist might dismiss it as unimportant. It doesn't matter why it exists. It simply exists. And if it didn't exist, we wouldn't be here to debate whether it existed or not. So we're here. We're debating the existence and why it exists. So it doesn't really matter, does it? That's like saying, I don't care what 2 plus 2 equals. I don't care why I'm here, or why I have less money in my bank account than I thought I did. It's pretty much every time I check my bank account. You know, to immediately dispel this idea that it doesn't matter, the question of why we're here, who made us all, why does it exist, to dispel that notion that it's unimportant, consider this analogy. If you were tied up in front of a firing squad with 10 soldiers, all of them had loaded guns, and you were blindfolded, and you heard all 10 guns fire, and the blindfold was removed, and you were not shot, wouldn't you want to know why? Now, again, the atheist argument is, you're not shot, it doesn't matter. But that's not how the human brain works. Don't you want to know why you were not shot by the firing squad? The mere fact that you're there debating it means there's a curiosity. Why does it all exist? Well, let's start with this first initial concept. That is, that infinity is nowhere to be found in nature. There is no such thing as infinite in the reality. According to David Hilbert, who is perhaps the greatest mathematician of the 20th century, the infinite is nowhere to be found in reality. It neither exists in nature nor provides a legitimate basis for rational thought. The role that remains for the infinite to play is solely that of an idea. And I think what he's saying, without realizing it, is basically Ecclesiastes 3, verse 11. that God has set eternity or infinity in their hearts, the hearts of men, yet so that man will not find out the work which God has done from the beginning to the end. I believe what Ecclesiastes 3:11 is saying is, we have a sense of what eternity is. We have a vague concept of infinity. But we can't really quantify it. We can't really explain it. We can't really comprehend it fully. I can give you a textbook definition of what eternity or infinity is, but that doesn't mean I really understand it. So again, according to the Bible and this mathematician David Hilbert, there's no such thing as infinity in reality. Everything in reality is finite. Everything in reality has a beginning. Everything in reality is an effect of a cause, and every cause is itself an effect of another cause. Basically, all of reality is dominoes. So let's just understand this. And this is not debated in science. This is reality. Infinity is nowhere to be found in nature, so everything that exists has a beginning. Every effect has a cause. Do you believe the universe exists? Yes. And quite frankly, if you're talking to an atheist who's going to argue this point, time to move on. Don't cast your pearls before swine. The universe exists. Therefore, the universe had a beginning. The universe is an effect of a cause. Given this conclusion that everything has a beginning, everything is finite, and the universe also had a beginning and must have as itself a first cause of some kind, it necessarily follows that whatever the first cause is or was must itself be uncaused, eternal, and immaterial. The reason I say that is because of the dominoes. Now, you could look at a row of dominoes all knocked over, and you could start at the end of it and work your way backward, that this domino was knocked over by this one, and this one was knocked over by this one, and you could work your way all the way back to the beginning, and at some point, you're going to get to a domino that doesn't have a domino before it. And you are left to make the conclusion that there was some first cause that exists outside the chain of dominoes. There is some first cause to all other causes and effects. There is a first initiator, something that started the universe, that must exist outside the universe. Now, it has to exist outside the universe, because if it was part of this universe, then it had to have had a cause, right? Because everything has a cause. Everything is finite. So whatever the first cause was must itself be uncaused. Whatever the first cause was must itself be infinite, because everything in this universe is finite. So the first cause cannot be finite. Whatever the first cause was or is must be immaterial. It has to be not created, not physical, because everything in the universe that is material is the product of a cause. Does that make sense to you? Whatever that first cause is or was has to be a transcendent first cause and must be fully existent outside the constraints of the universe in which we live. It must be bigger. It must last longer. Incomprehensibly so. I believe that the universe itself bears this out. From everything that we observe in the universe itself, the fine-tuning of all things bears out God. The fine-tuning of the universe that makes life on our planet possible requires a better explanation than just accident or chaos or coincidence, which of course the atheist will throw out all three of those as possible explanations. From Eric Lyons, who writes for Apologetics Press, he had this to say. In a recent New Scientist cover story about gravity, Michael Brooks described the force of gravity as strange, mysterious, and puzzling. And remember, New Scientist is not a Christian publication or a creationist publication. He had this. He insisted that one reason gravity does not make sense to him is because it appears to be fine-tuned. He wrote this out of this 2009 article. If it, that is gravity, were a tiny bit stronger, none of us would even be here to scoff at its puny nature. Now, regarding the expansion of space after the alleged Big Bang and the pull of gravity, Brooks went on to write this. It turns out that the struggle between these two balanced forces is balanced on a knife's edge. Dr. William Lane Craig also uses the term balanced on a knife edge. If the expansion of space had overwhelmed the pull of gravity in our newborn universe, stars, galaxies, and humans would never have been able to form. If, on the other hand, gravity had been much stronger, stars and galaxies might have formed, but they would have quickly collapsed in on themselves and each other. What's more, the gravitational distortion of space-time would have folded up the universe in a big crunch. Our cosmic history would have been over by now. And that's just one element of fine-tuning. There is a middle ground that exists in every force in this universe that allows our lives to exist. You only exist because you are in that middle ground. You only exist because incomprehensibly large numbers, incomprehensibly fine-tuned factors make your life possible. But it must be accident, right? It must be chance. I mean, the reason why we're all here, the reason why it all exists, that's what the atheist would argue, that it's all just chance. That something collided with something else, that from nothing, everything came into existence. From timelessness, time began. From the immaterial, the material simply sprang into being. I'm sorry, but those who assert that all of this exists simply because of chance or coincidence would never accept such unbelievable odds in any other area of life. Dr. Craig had this to say. The physicist PCW Davies has calculated that a change in the strength of gravity or of the atomic weak force by only one part in 10 to the 100th power. That's a lot of zeros. If the change of gravity or the atomic weak force was different by only 1 in 10 to the 100th power, it would have prevented a life-permitting universe. I'll give you some bigger numbers, by the way, because you know I'm so good at math. The cosmological constant, which supposedly drives the inflation of the universe and is responsible for the recently discovered acceleration of that expansion, is inexplicably fine-tuned to around one part in 10 to the 120th power. Roger Penrose of Oxford University has calculated that the odds of the Big Bang's low entropy condition existing by chance, that is everything that would have allowed the Big Bang to happen, by chance, is in the order of 1 in 10 to the 10 times 123rd power. Penrose commented this. This is a quote from Roger Penrose at Oxford. I cannot even recall seeing anything else in physics whose accuracy is known to approach even remotely a figure like 1 part in 10 to the 10 times 123rd power. And it's not just each constant or quantity which must be exquisitely fine-tuned. It's the ratios of one thing to another that also must be fine-tuned. So the improbability is multiplied by improbability until our minds are reeling in incomprehensible numbers. Now, no scientist would explain or accept these unbelievable odds in any other area of science. And yet, when it comes to the universe's origins, they're all too happy to simply say, it was an accident, or coincidence, or chaos. If even one condition in our universe was different, then none of us would even be here to debate it. From Answers in Genesis, the writer has this to say of various finely tuned conditions in our universe. The electromagnetic coupling constant binds electrons to protons and atoms. If it was smaller, fewer electrons could be held together. If it was larger, electrons would be held too tightly to bond with other atoms. So what he's saying is, literally, not a single part of you would be held together. Ratio of electron to proton mass is about 1 to 1,836. And again, if this was any larger or smaller, molecules could not form. Every single part of you could not exist as it is. Carbon and oxygen nuclei, which of course are pretty necessary for life to exist, have finely tuned energy levels. Our sun is the exact right color. If our sun was any redder or any bluer, then photosynthetic response would not be possible. Our sun is also the right mass. If it was any larger, its brightness would change too quickly, and there would be too much high-energy radiation for us to live. If it was any smaller, the range of planetary distances also to support life would be too narrow. The right distance would be so close to the star that tidal forces would disrupt our planet's rotational period. UV radiation would also be inadequate for photosynthesis. The Earth's distance from the sun is also crucial for stable water cycles. Too far away and most water would freeze. Too close and most water would boil. The Earth's gravity, its axial tilt, its rotation period, its magnetic field, its crust thickness, its oxygen to nitrogen ratio, carbon dioxide, water vapor, and ozone levels are all just right. And again, like Craig said, it's not just that one of these things has to be right for us to exist. It is that all of these things must be fine-tuned by themselves and finely tuned in ratio to each other to make life possible. All of this makes sense to the Christian, by the way. I don't know any Christian who's flummoxed by his own existence. We have always known that a design requires a designer. That a universe that makes sense is a reflection of an omnipotent and omniscient, omnipresent, eternal creator. That something that is finely tuned must have had one to fine-tune it. In Psalm 8 and verse 3, the universe is described as the work of God's fingers. Colossians 1 and verse 17 says, "In Him all things hold together." Romans 1 and verse 20, that you can see God in the creation in its orderliness. And in Genesis chapter 1, "In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth." A pre-existent, non-material, eternal first cause who exists entirely outside of the constraints of this physical universe. God, as the Bible describes Him, is the only logical conclusion that one can come to about where the universe came from. If God does not exist, then we are left with a dizzying question that cannot be answered, and a life that has no hope. But Lego. You know, as it turns out, you can have a bunch of Lego bricks in a bag, shake them around a few times, even if the set is easy to build, and you don't make much of anything at all. That's a Lego set with 100 pieces. Your body has billions of cells, and you exist in an environment with trillions upon trillions of cells. In a universe with an incalculable number of stars and planets and heavenly bodies. If you don't think God exists, I'm not sure there's a whole lot more that we can tell you. But look at your hands. Look at the stars. And come to the only logical conclusion that you can. Now, if you're not a Christian here this morning, you really ought to be. You will have the eternal hope that God promises, an eternal hope to spend all of your post-death existence, timeless, eternal, with Him in heaven. There's more to this life than what you can see. Stop living by sight. Stop living by the physical, your earthly treasures, your job, your physical body, and start walking by faith. Won't you join God's church in this life and in the next? Won't you please come forward as we stand and sing?